Hello, everyone, and welcome to New Books in French Studies, discussions with scholars of France and the Francophone world about their new books. I'm your host, Roxane Panchassi. My guest today is Michael Goebel, the author of Anti-Imperial Metropolis, Interwar Paris and the Seeds of Third World Nationalism. And the book was published by Cambridge University Press in 2015. Hi there, Michael.
Hello there.
Could you get us started by telling us a little bit about yourself and what got you interested in working on France?
Yeah, so I'm originally from Germany, and I studied history first in Germany and later in the UK. But I'm originally a historian of Latin America, more specifically Argentina. My first book, which was based on my PhD, which I did at University College London, was on nationalism in 20th century Argentina. So really, I arrived at this topic and this book in a funny way, which was that I first became interested in Paris as a site for exchange for Latin American intellectuals in the 20th century, and specifically in the interwar period, which had interested me also in my first book. So I was originally looking for Latin American nationalists and anti-imperialists in interwar Paris, and they still linger on in the book, if you like, but in many ways they are the odd ones out, because as I descended into French archives, I found very little on Latin Americans, and in particular very, very little political information on Latin Americans in French archives. I did find things, you know, related to drunk driving and things like that, but that didn't interest me so much. But I did find a lot on French colonial subjects. So really the whole project gradually became modified, and I looked less and less at Latin Americans and more at French colonial subjects in interwar Paris and their politics, largely because the archives told me so much more about them than they did about Latin Americans, for obvious reasons, which was that the French state had a security interest in the politics of French colonial subjects, but not really a security interest in the politics of Latin American expats in Paris.
What made Paris such a special place in this period of time with respect to the themes and issues you're interested in?
So, first of all, I suppose, you know, Paris has always and still is a special place in so many ways that, you know, stirs everybody's imagination. I quote from a book by Jamaican-born author Claude McKay, who says that Paris was the patrie of the imagination of so many people. And that's not necessarily specific to the interwar period. Walter Benjamin famously called it the capital of the 19th century and so forth. But the interwar period is different from earlier periods in that for the first time, significant numbers of non-Europeans, including French colonial subjects, come to the city, which has a lot to do with World War I, because the French state, you know, as you know, recruited many people from its colonies as workers and soldiers for the war effort, and most of them were forcefully repatriated at the war's end. But some of them remained. Some of them went to their home countries, but then back to Paris for labor reasons. So it really marks the beginning of much later post-colonial migrations to Paris that really took up momentum after World War II. And it was, of course, in the interwar period, as it was earlier, a city that was terribly important for global intellectual exchange for students, not only, of course, from non-European countries, but many from, you know, Eastern and Southern Europe as well. So it was much more so than other European cities at the time, a very cosmopolitan place, perhaps almost as much as New York. By 1930, it had 10% foreign-born population, which excludes people from French colonies who technically weren't foreigners, but French colonial subjects, and therefore don't make it into censuses normally as foreigners. So, but if you count them in, then you get, you know, a percentage like 13% of people born outside of metropolitan France. living in the Paris region, which clearly makes it Europe's most cosmopolitan city at the time. And it tends to play a larger role than London, let alone, you know, Brussels or Berlin in the cultural imagination of people outside of Europe.
You've mentioned a couple of times now, Michael, the numbers. And I'm just wondering, how do we know for the interwar years, when we're talking about numbers of non-Europeans and distinguishing between colonial subjects and foreigners, where do we get our numbers from for this period?
From a range of sources, really, but most of it are estimates. But once you've read 10 of them,
sure,
you can first of all build an average, and you also get a feeling, you know, which are the outliers in the estimates. So they do add up to not reliable numbers, but, you know, a range of numbers that you think will be likely more or less true. Some are from censuses that counts mostly for foreigners, such as Chinese and Latin Americans. They do pop up in the census, and that's presumably more or less reliable. It's a lot more difficult for French colonial subjects, but since the French state and in particular the colonial ministry built such a huge surveillance apparatus, they were constantly busy guessing numbers also. And they did keep track of who came into the country and who went out, more or less. Although you do get a low degree of clandestine immigration, but nothing that would hugely distort the numbers.
In the introduction to the book, you described the project as much more of a social history of migration than an intellectual history of anti-imperialism. So I want to ask you about this orientation of the book as a social history.
It's one of the major arguments of the book, and of course it is an argument that works better for some of the groups I look at than it does for others. And it's also an argument that actually works better for Paris than it would for London, so in London, if you get people from the British Empire, they tend to come from the elites, and they tend to go to London not for labor reasons. In Paris, that's different. You get significant labor migrations, in particular from Africa, and especially from North Africa. And it's for those people that the argument works best. The argument that this is a social history of migration, or that the social history of migration matters for the long-term history of national movements in Africa and Asia. That argument, first of all, that works better for some people than for others, but it's also an argument that is unusual, because most of the time, people like Ho Chi Minh, who of course comes up in the book because he spent significant time in Paris, in the 1920s, are treated as, you know, later politicians and at the time perhaps intellectuals who in Paris read Lenin. So, If there was a literature about, let's say, Ho Chi Minh in Paris in the 1920s, it looked at him mostly from the angle of intellectual and political history. And I looked at it largely because the sources allowed me to do so from the angle of a social history of migration. So I'm less interested in prominent individuals such as Ho Chi Minh, although he pops up in the book, and much more in the life of communities and ordinary people, which could include students who went to Paris, and how their experience of migration, of, you know, different legal statuses, of unequal treatment shaped their political ideas. That is really what I look at, and that is what I mean by social history of migration and how this became important eventually for the intellectual history of nationalism and decolonization.
To the extent that this is both a social history and a history that takes place at a very specific time in the city, would you also characterize this study as a social geography? And I'm just thinking here of the, you know, opening pages of the book where I really felt situated in the city around Place d'Italie. And I was thinking as I was reading, and you come back to this a number of times in the book, about which city, which Paris and Parises you're engaging with, and the spaces of the city and neighborhoods and some of those kinds of things. Do you see your book as a contribution along those lines?
Let's say I wanted it to be. although I'm not sure to what extent I succeeded in doing this. I as you say in the book, on several occasions I try to, you know, I give some maps of where, for example, Algerian workers lived, mm-hmm. or Vietnamese workers lived in Paris, or I give examples of specific meeting places, or, you know, conjectures of how they might have met because their daily circuits in the city possibly brought them to the same places. Some prominent industrial places like the Renault Citroën factory where mm-hmm. lots of colonial workers worked and presumably met and so forth. The problem is, Well, and I did some other things also, looking at addresses and specific hotels where successions of migrants who were brought there through networks were housed. So, for example, I could find specific addresses, apartments where throughout the interwar years in the 1920s, a succession of Vietnamese workers lived, who were all obviously brought there through networks. So someone goes back to Vietnam and someone else comes instead and moves into the same apartment, let's say. So I looked at the geography of the city in those ways, and the sources again allowed me to do that, and I enjoyed doing that. But I wasn't always sure at the end of the day how much of that geographical focus is ornamental to the argument, let's say, because you can pin down specific, let's say, theaters or meeting places that the Communist Party used and where they went and so forth, but I'm not so sure how much this has to do with the geographic history of Paris per se, or the urban history of Paris. So the short answer to the question is I wanted this to be also an urban history of Paris, and in the end I think it was less an urban history of Paris than I initially hoped for, because I often felt that those geographical questions actually tell me less about the eventually political history that I wanted to arrive at than I initially hoped for.
I also wanted to ask you, Michael, about the way that the book is positioned with respect to studies of colonialism. In the beginning of the book and then throughout, you come back to some of the terminology. You explore questions of, you know, how we think about imperialism versus colonialism, how we think about the globalization. Could you say a little bit more about the theoretical frameworks that you're drawing on and what type of response the book is to some of these terms and concepts?
Yeah, absolutely. So I'll try to answer specifically to the two questions about anti-imperialism and the term global. And in particular, in with regards to the term anti-imperialism, which of course is also in the book title, like so many other terms and concepts I use, it came out of a pragmatic choice, which I then tried to justify in a more theoretical, profound way. First of all, I prefer to speak of anti-imperialism because it was a term that I found a lot more in the sources than mm-hmm. anti-colonialism. But also because the book includes, as I said earlier, people who are not from formerly colonial domains, in particular Latin Americans, but also Chinese student workers, which is a prominent, although numerically small, migration to Paris, because from that group of Chinese student workers then hailed later very prominent Chinese communists such as Zhou Enlai. And since they don't come from formerly colonial countries, they wouldn't have been referred to at the time nor later as anti-colonialists primarily, but used the term anti-imperialist. So first of all, I prefer to speak of imperialism because it was a term that I found more often in the sources, but also because I felt it was a more capacious category compared to colonialism. With it, I wanted to also then make a theoretical intervention in showing that there were connections between people who come from the French Empire and people who come from formerly independent countries who count as foreigners. One of the examples I give in the book are Haitians, who are, again, numerically a very small group in Paris, but they're very important as brokers for Pan-African concerns in Paris. Also because they have access to, as foreigners, they have access to diplomatic channels. So they can, you know, speak, for example, on behalf of Cameroonian nationalists before the League of Nations and things like that. So I wanted to show in many ways the overlap between nationalists or anti-imperialists from formerly independent countries, such as Haiti or Latin American countries, or the Chinese, who often worked as brokers for proxies or spokesmen for the Vietnamese community. In terms of the global, I'm skeptical, like other people, about how useful that category is, because to so many listeners or readers, it conjures up the notion that you want to cover the entire globe, or that you speak about phenomena that you think are equally spread across the globe, which of course is not the case at all. And and in so many ways, I want to show, even though I treat, you know, let's say Latin Americans and Algerians and Chinese and Vietnamese all in one book, in so many ways, the book is meant to show the discrepancies between these different groups and the huge differences, and how those discrepancies and differences became productive via comparisons and contrasts that people drew between the status of, let's say, French Antillians and Vietnamese and the like, because they were so different. So when I speak of global, I don't want to make a claim, you know, that there was some sort of evenness in the spread of anti-imperialism across the globe, because they were all in equal measure and in similar ways victims of imperialism. No, there were stark differences, and they became important. And this is how I use the term global.
So, Michael, in bringing to the history a focus on Paris and the metropole, at least as the site where these ideas and communities are interacting and moving about, one could make the argument that you're restoring the center. Could you say something about how you negotiate that idea in the book of focusing on Paris, focusing on the European context, and, you know, what you mentioned at least once in the book as sort of being making a contribution to the project of provincializing Europe?
Yeah. It's a tough question to answer. So first of all, let me begin this way. There was a challenge in the book because, as I said earlier, I'm by training a historian of Latin America. Mm-hmm. So, and I now began to research and eventually write about people from, let's say, Algeria, West Africa, Vietnam. And my background in Vietnamese history was lacking. And I was acutely conscious of the problem that I might underestimate the importance of local roots of feelings against colonialism. And they are extremely important. So, but my only way of dealing with this since I looked at Paris, was by introducing a few caveats, like, you know, whoever went through forced labor in West Africa or in the Chinese prisons needed no lessons in why colonialism had its problems, to say the least. Mm-hmm. So I did not want to minimize the importance of local roots in feelings against colonialism, which I think still are crucial. On the other hand, I wanted to ask a question, and I think I did ask a question of why a place like Paris became so crucial in forming so many of later post-colonial elites. And that was well known, of course, before the book, you know, that people like Ho Chi Minh, is actually an exception among the people that I look at, because he was in many ways politicized before he arrived in Paris. But so many of the other people, you know, went through a process of politicization in Paris. And I wanted to account for that. And so I bring back the center in terms of place in that I look at Paris and how Paris became such a, such a what I call a hatchery for those post-colonial elites. But I don't necessarily bring back the center in terms of looking at how French people taught, you know, colonial subjects about nationalism, which was an older argument of the nationalism literature, really, that you know, nationalism was European invention, and then people who went to Europe picked up the idea and then brought it back home, but it really was elaborated by Europeans who then taught or trained people from the colonies who then re-imported it back to their country. So, and I don't really look at European actors as much as I do look at the experience of non-European actors in Paris. So I bring the center back spatially, if you like, but not so much mm-hmm. in terms of the actors because I almost exclusively look at actors from outside of Europe, which actually is a criticism that has also been leveled against the book. Where are the French actors in the book? And it's true, you know, some like Henri Barbusse make their appearance and they are important, of course, but they don't really have much centrality in the book. So one could also say, you know, you should have looked much more at French people than you do.
Well, and that's always a potential conversation about any book, I suppose, that especially one that's trying to deal with so many different communities and actors. Just with respect to sources, Michael, you mentioned in the introduction, you know, that you looked at over 15 archives in 8 countries. And I wanted to ask what types of different materials you're using to access the everyday lives of both foreigners and colonial subjects in the capital, in the French capital. What were some of the challenges that you faced in locating materials or working with different types of perspectives in the sources that you found?
Yeah, thanks for the question. I always love to speak about the sources because they were really the bedrock of this project. So I did look at a lot of different sources and as you said, in different countries, which was also important for the Latin Americans and in particular people from independent countries, which included then also, you know, some personal correspondences and personal archives, periodicals, memoirs, sometimes published books and like, but the bulk of the material are French official sources, some of them from the French Foreign Ministry, which again was important when it came to foreigners rather than colonial subjects. Some of them are from the French Interior Ministry, which was, of course, important for policing and also important for Algerians because officially Algeria didn't fall into the remit of the colonial ministry. But other than that, the bulk of the material comes from surveillance documents in the French colonial ministry archive in Aix-en-Provence. Mm-hmm. So those are essentially police records and by and large, they are daily surveillance records of undercover agents that were infiltrated into anti-colonial movements in the metropole. And they produced almost daily surveillance reports to their superiors. And that is where, numerically speaking, the bulk of the material comes from. And police records, of course, first of all, they're a fascinating source because you can, as a historian, it's the closest you get to being a detective as a historian, in particular, as you try to uncover the identities of those undercover agents, which were infiltrated in those movements. And they're a very ambiguous source. On the one hand, they, of course, reflect the prejudices, sometimes the racism, And the concerns and goals of the French authorities. On the other hand, since those are undercover agents who in many cases were recruited by the French state when they ran into trouble with the law or in exchange for French citizenship or the like. So undercover agents who had formed part of those movements before they became undercover agents. And you get some. For example, a Malagasy war veteran who first draws close to anti-colonial movements, then becomes recruited as an undercover agent. Then all along for about 10 years, remains a faithful member of the French Communist Party, becomes the president of some of those movements, and you get the feeling that actually the man continues to be genuine in his anti-colonial persuasions while he's doing a little spying on the side. So the sources are very ambiguous in the sense that they are a funny blend of the perspective of activists themselves, you know, mixed up with the viewpoint of the French authorities.
I want to move on now to ask you about sort of the arc of the chapters in the book. And you describe the book as moving from the local social history of non-Europeans to get to the intellectual history of anti-imperial nationalism. So in the first few chapters of the book, Michael, you outline non-European migrations to interwar Paris. And you make the point that the different social, political, legal relationships between these different groups who arrive in France and in the capital showed up the inconsistencies and fault lines in the imperial order. Could you say a little bit more about how that worked?
Yeah, so first of all, there's of course a distinction that I mentioned a few times already, which is between foreigners and colonial subjects, or colonials rather, because not all people from French colonies are subjects. Some are citizens, Antillians in particular, but also some people from Senegal. So first of all, there's a fault line between foreigners and colonial people from French colonies. Most of the foreigners I deal with are Latin Americans and Chinese, and they are theoretically treated in the same way as Germans would be treated, or North Americans, U.S. citizens would be treated in interwar Paris. But they don't necessarily have similar social profiles. So Latin Americans are mostly wealthy, expats. Chinese are mostly relatively poor, workers, or some of them are worker students. So legally they are all foreigners, but there's big differences between them in terms of their social profiles. And then it becomes a lot more complicated when you look at people from French colonies, because they are very different. They're very diverse and heterogeneous among themselves in terms of, well, their numbers, their social profiles, and their legal status. First of all, if you talk about numbers, then North Africans are by far the largest group, something like 70 or 80,000 by 1930, most of them from Algeria, but also quite a few Moroccans. And then all people from all other French colonies are never really more than 15,000 altogether. Among them, Vietnamese, West Africans, Antillians, and very few from other regions. North Africans and West Africans are mostly poor and working class. The Vietnamese have quite a few students among them from wealthy bourgeois backgrounds, in particular in southern Vietnam. Antillians are also much more wealthy than Africans. They have lawyers, dentists, doctors among them. Some of them are older. There are more women among them also. Most North Africans and West Africans are male. And then there's different legal statuses, depending on where exactly you come from. So Antillians in particular, are different in that they are French citizens, which entitles them to a whole host of rights that let's say Algerians, and by Algerians I mean Algerian Muslims, can only dream of. So there's really an enormous patchwork of people who are very different in their status and social profile, and in their reasons for coming to France, and you know, the areas where they live, the groups they mingle with, the occupations they have, and many other things. And that discrepancy over time becomes something like an engine of comparison between different groups. So one group I look at is founded in 1920, immediately after the war, is a group that unites essentially Antillean lawyers who are French citizens with Malagasy war veterans. And Antillean lawyers essentially become spokesmen for Malagasy war veterans who claim French citizenship for their war service. So this is a typical example of one of those groups where people start to extrapolate, or Malagasys in this case, start to extrapolate from the Antillean case and say, look, if they have French citizenship, why don't we? And you can find lots of examples of where groups join in different political associations and begin comparing and contrasting their own legal situation, social profile, home country to that of others, which essentially gives them new ideas, let's say. So this is how this discrepancy or this very uneven landscape becomes fruitful for political ideas.
In this first part of the book, Michael, where you're really looking at everyday life for these various groups in Paris, there's a really interesting way in which you're moving between considering private life, sexual relations, family life, generation, the children of some of these people who arrive in Paris, popular culture, the landscape of, where people eat and the music they listen to and where they go to socialize, community associations. And there's sort of this continuum from the private to the public. And you're also charting the story of politicization. So could you say a little bit about the interaction between public and private in this first part of the book, and also between culture and politics?
Yeah, absolutely. So, yeah, as you said, those, especially chapter 2 and 3, they try to follow this logic of politicization. And I look a lot at mutual aid associations and formerly apolitical associations, which really claim to and do cater to everyday concerns of people from the colonies in the metropole. And many of those associations, which, provide medical care or offer legal advice if you want to open a Vietnamese restaurant, let's say, encounter stumbling blocks, in particular of a legal kind. If this whole project or this whole book taught me anything about history in very general ways, it is how terribly important legal history is. And so those mutual aid associations offer legal advice and the like, and in the process obviously realize that, ethnic origin and those whole regimes of legal exception that rule over their home countries matter in order to decide what you're allowed to do and not to do in the metropole. So those formerly apolitical associations gradually enter a logic of politicization. And I try to show that with several examples. One interesting example has to do with intimacy, sexuality, and in particular marriage, which you just hinted at. So at some point I found that, so first of all, most of those, I'm talking now about communities from the French colonies rather than foreigners. So if you look at North Africans, West Africans, but also Vietnamese, the vast majority of them are men. And we're talking about something like 98% in their 20s. And so, demographically speaking, of course, this favors contact with French women. In spite of this demographic situation, actually such marriages are pretty rare. And the French state tries to discourage them. Mm-hmm. With some success, it seems, if one can speak of success here, tries to discourage them. And again, this for some activists proves an engine of their politicization. When they have to familiarize themselves with, civil law, due to their colonial background and stumbling blocks to marriage with French women, or what happens to their children? Are they allowed to go back to Vietnam, let's say, and the like? And I eventually found that, in particular, if you look at the leadership of political anti-colonial organizations, a vast majority of those leaders are married or live with French women, when very few of the rank and file people, let's say, are married or live with French women. So this told me something about how, intimate contact with in this case French women seems to have played a role in politicization.
In one of the chapters of the book, I think it's chapter 5, Michael, obviously all of what's happening in the book is connected in various ways to what's going on in the big picture of, or the other picture, I suppose, of international relations and diplomacy and crises and wars. I mean, these things are happening while the book is happening. But in chapter 5, you look at a few key moments of, you know, diplomatic watersheds and crises, the Paris Peace Conference, the Refor, and the Italian invasion of Ethiopia. And you have this notion that you pursue in this chapter of shadow diplomacy. Could you tell us what that means and how you're using that idea in that chapter and maybe at other points in the book?
Yeah, so I look at those three moments because there were moments of heightened activism, let's say, which also brought people together from different backgrounds. The most obvious case is the Paris Peace Conference, mm-hmm. but 1925 or several events in 1925 did so also, as did the Italian invasion of Ethiopia. And then I introduced this concept of shadow diplomacy, by which I mean essentially that increasingly foreigners with access to diplomatic channels act as proxies for colonial subjects. You can see that during the Paris Peace Conference, when, for example, Egyptians to some extent operate as spokesmen for Tunisians and in particular Algerians, or when Ho Chi Minh increasingly begins to cooperate with later Chinese communists or Chinese nationalists at the time who are also involved in activism because of the Paris Peace Conference. There's a wonderful book by Aris Manila about this, of course. So Ho Chi Minh increasingly, for example, approaches Chinese activists, Chinese nationalists around Paris at the time, distributes leaflets about the demands of the Vietnamese people at the meetings of those Chinese activists, compares himself to those Chinese activists, and the Chinese activists increasingly actually do disseminate the material that Vietnamese activists such as Ho Chi Minh give them. So they act as proxies or spokesmen for those Vietnamese activists at the time. There are essentially two reasons for this cooperation. One is that simply in those moments which you know kindle or stir more political activities from different people, they increasingly interact, which means that this shadow diplomacy in which, for example, Chinese work for the Vietnamese increasingly becomes probable. But the other thing is that it allows people like Ho Chi Minh or, let's say, Algerian activists during certain moments to escape the French security radar. Because the French are not so interested in what the Chinese are doing or what the Egyptians are doing. It is a way for, or let's say, Senegalese working with Haitians of finding subterfuge among foreigners who have access to diplomatic channels and can legitimately operate in the arena of international relations, which colonial subjects cannot.
What about the role of political parties? And I guess I'm thinking very specifically of the French left and in the international left and of, you know, the role of communism in this story. I know there's a focus on it in Chapter 6, but when we think about anti-colonial activists, especially, there is certainly this important set of connections with communism in France. So what can you tell us about that?
Yeah, so communism and both the Comintern and the French Communist Party are absolutely crucial. Mm-hmm. In this whole story of politicization for various reasons. Most anti-colonialists, or almost all anti-colonialists, sympathize with the political left. And within the French left-wing political spectrum, the French Communist Party is really the only one that systematically adopts anti-colonial or anti-imperial positions, at least on paper. So the communists are by far the most important. With Lenin's book on imperialism, they also furnish them, you know, with a coherent theory about imperialism, which of course people like Ho Chi Minh adopt pretty early on. But the Communist Party, the French Communist Party, and the Comintern also become very important organizationally. Essentially in providing a platform for anti-colonialists to speak. And again, the communists are the only political player in the French political spectrum who do that systematically. Although on occasion, more reformist critics of colonialism, for example, from Algeria, also sympathize with French socialists and work with them to some extent. But the Communist Party is the most important. The main reason for the French Communist Party to adopt anti-colonial positions is ideological. But it is also because Moscow tells them to do that. Apart from ideology, actually, the French Communist Party doesn't have a whole lot of incentives to enlist people from the French colonies or help anti-colonialists from the colonies in the metropole. It's an electoral party from early on. Colonial subjects cannot vote. So there are relatively few incentives to do that apart from, ideology and Moscow telling them to do so. But to some extent, the French Communist Party does so and thus provides also a platform for exchange, for people from different colonies. One of the famous examples of this, which I treat also in the book, is a group called, Intercolonial Union. Mm-hmm. And it was founded in 1921 and was then essentially financed by the French Communist Party. It breaks apart in 1926-27 into different national subgroups, like an Algerian group called Étoile Nord-Africaine, mm-hmm. Vietnamese Independence Party, and a few more groups, which then go their own ways organizationally, although they then in certain ways become reorganized by the Comintern directly from Moscow. So this is taken out of the French Communist Party into the remit of Moscow, which organizes them in a more internationalist way, if you like, and treats them as if they were national parties. So this reinforces in a way this dynamic of nationalization that you first have an intercolonial group, but it eventually becomes a series of Comintern orchestrated nationalist parties from different parts of the French Empire. This is then advertised at a famous conference in Brussels in 1927.
Along the lines of, the book's pursuit of ideological traces and influences, one of the contributions that you're making here that I found really fascinating is the ways in which anti-imperialism references republicanism and the French Revolution and the ways that this very specifically French notion of human rights or equality, that these notions become a kind of lingua franca.
Yeah. So first of all, this harks back to one of your earlier questions in what is specific about Paris. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that is specific about Paris, or maybe France rather than Paris, is this republicanism, which you don't get necessarily for the British Empire. And it has to do, obviously, with the fact that France is an empire, but also a republic, which is an oddity, let's say, on the world map. And so what anti-colonialists do a lot is that they adopt this republican language of equal rights and then hold it against the French colonial state, basically charging the French colonial state with practicing hypocrisy, which is absolutely true. So how can you speak of liberté, égalité, fraternité and have this slogan, grace the walls of Indochinese prisons, let's say? Mm-hmm. This is the essential rhetorical move that they make. And this is where they adopt this republican language, which then absolutely pervades all of those groups, regardless of whether they are gradualist reformers or radicals and communists. Although their language, of course, differs, but they all adopt in one way or another this republican language, let's say. But it also speaks to a current topic, which is debated very much at this moment, and in particular, if you look at the press coverage of recent events in France, and in particular terrorist attacks, and that has to do with the degree to which French republicanism and assimilationism disallows ethnic identity politics. Mm-hmm. So especially in Britain, perhaps more so that even than the United States, there's an argument that, French republicanism and assimilationism, essentially ended up as a head in the sand attitude towards ethnic problems in the banlieue. And, you should adopt a more multicultural approach, which allows, ethnic difference and therefore is much more effective in dealing with this. I think some of this is true, although what I see in the 1920s is that this Republican rhetoric is not at all incompatible with organizing your political associations on ethnic grounds, let's say. So most of the groups I look at both adopt this Republican language, but at the same time feel entitled to make claims about ethnic particularity and difference. So make non-assimilationist arguments, if you like. This is one of the things I found most interesting in view of current debates about the French Republic and how the French Republic relates to ethnic minorities. So in the 1920s, I found that many of the people I deal with find this republicanism, I felt, surprisingly compatible with ethnic identity politics.
You describe the book, Michael, as a prehistory of the Third World and of the nationalisms, regionalisms, and decolonizations that come after World War II. So I wanted to ask how you see this book as sort of a genealogy of the post-war period and of this notion of the Third World in particular.
It's in two ways a bit of a complicated and perhaps even anachronistic argument to make. One is that I don't really deal with the post-World War II period, so that I don't necessarily trace what happened to the people that I look at in the book after World War II. It's rather a premise that I say, look, so many of the people who rose to prominence after World War II, and I'm not going to look at that, have this genealogy in the interwar period. Now let's look at the interwar period, which I then posit made them what they eventually became. So the argument about eventual decolonization, I don't really fledge out very much in the book. It's more of a premise. Now the term Third World, I thought about that a lot and whether it was useful to employ that term. And I'm still skeptical. Again, it's a choice for lack of a better word. I could have said non-European or something like that, which I felt didn't sound very nice either. And since I also deal with Latin Americans, I wonder, a catchy term that made clear what I was talking about. Although I do think that much of the rhetoric that I analyze in the book later pervades, let's say, the Conference of Bandung or the tricontinental conferences that come out of Cuba, and also this term Third World, which of course is later also Parisian invention in the 1950s. So I do think there's a genealogy of this talk about, oppressed nations having something in common and having to address their problems in common that I can see already in the 1920s, which then really pervades this Third World discourse later in after World War II. The other question, of course, is whether it's useful to employ the term nationalism, which is also in the title, and I discussed that in the last chapter of the book. There's now a strong trend in the literature to be skeptical about the term nationalism, associated especially with Frederick Cooper's writings, who he insists very much on the long-term availability of alternatives to nation states, and that that the outcome of nation states wasn't inevitable, and, mm-hmm. and we should look at federal alternatives or imperial citizenship options that really lingered on up until 1960. And then only very late in the day became undone, he claims. I, by contrast, for various reasons, we don't probably have the time to go into them, treat most of the political movements and activists I deal with as nationalists nonetheless. First of all, because they did play a role in eventually bringing about independent nation states, many of them from very early on. This goes especially for Asia. Very clearly advocated independent nation states from early on. So if anything, you know, the argument that nationalism only became important very late can be made about Africa much more than it can about Asia. So there's a series of reasons why I treat them as nationalists anyway, and that is something that I tried to explain in the last chapter, the eighth chapter of the book.
So, Michael, we've talked about just about every word in the title, but I want to ask you about one of the words that's not specifically in the title, but that I kept thinking about as I was reading the book, which is race, particularly in a France where that can be such a thorny issue to discuss because of a kind of persistent refusal of it as a category.
So race, of course, is absolutely crucial in so many ways and for almost all of the, although not all of the activists I look at. Mm. Now, first of all, as you say, and as one might expect in the French context, the term race or race is not used very often mm-hmm. in the sources that I look at. And that of course is, one can argue, you know, is silencing of a term that is nonetheless crucial. The term racism is sometimes used, or racisme, although interestingly, mostly by most often by Algerian activists, who were also in many ways the most discriminated against, although not only for racial reasons, of course, but also for it is an intersectional overlap of many things: legal status, you know, social profiles, where do they work, and so forth. So many of the Algerians, for example, are from Kabylie or Berber-speaking Algerian Muslims, whom the French colonial state famously construed as white. So race is one in a set of categories that shape the experiences of the people I look at, and not always the most prominent one among them. So on many occasions I speak of ethnicity rather than race, which is of course not the same thing, but as a somewhat more let's say less biological category and more capacious category that also deals more with everyday practices that are not necessarily reducible to race. But race is of course crucial to the experience of most of the people I look at. And you can argue that, you know, some people, let's say Latin Americans, who are a lot more bourgeois, different legal status, but are also treated differently for racial reasons, mostly urban white elites.
Well, Michael, there are about 100 other questions I'd like to ask you, but I'm just going to ask you one last one, which is, what are you working on now?
Yeah, so out of this book has come a greater interest in urban history. And in particular, I've become interested in the history of ethnic segregation in cities, which is already a small part of this book, although spatially speaking, Paris wasn't a terribly segregated space in the interwar period. But I have become very interested in this topic in general. And I try to look at it from the angle of several cities, especially in the late 19th century and early 20th century. I'll probably pick a few Latin American cities I know well, such as Buenos Aires and Havana, and compare them to a few Southeast Asian places. I just went to the archive in Manila, which is a famously segregated city at the time. And so that is a project I will try to pursue in the future whenever I have the time, because I'm not teaching.
Well, I wish you the best of luck with it. Michael, I just want to thank you so much for writing the book and for taking the time to speak with me about it today.
It's a pleasure. Thanks for having me on the program.